Well, hello everyone. Welcome to another Deepest Lore. I'm actually away doing an interview today, but I still wanted to make sure that a Deepest Lore went out. And I decided that I'm going to focus on just one album by an artist that I don't know very much about, Rick Wakeman. And the album is The Six Wives of Henry VIII, which I've been listening to quite a bit recently. Mainly, AAA isn't easy to get to sleep still. And one of the methods that typically works is going on a midnight drive. And I have been putting on this album, driving, you know, down country roads and things, 60 miles an hour, 70 miles an hour, rocking The Six Wives of Henry VIII. And I kind of got interested in, like, this album is bonkers. It's just kind of mad. And, you know, I was interested to know a bit more. And it's so, like, out of sync with everything else that was going on when it was released in 1973. And Wakeman himself, who's this kind of, you know, desperately uncool keyboard virtuoso. So I was interested to know, like, a bit more about this album, a bit, like, why did he make it, what's it about? Now, it's instrumental, and he apparently was going through an airport in America one day, and he came across this book on Henry VIII and his six wives, and he just kind of picked it up for a bit of light reading. And as he was reading it, he was inspired to write basically a track after each one of the six wives. And this is what this album is. So each of the tracks is called, you know, Catherine Howard, Catherine Parr, Catherine of Aragon, Jane Seymour, you know, the six wives of Henry VIII. For some reason, they're not in order. You know, they're not chronologically ordered on the album. So it starts with Catherine of Aragon, who is the first wife. But then it kind of jumps around. It goes to Anne of Cleves, then Catherine Howard, then Jane Seymour, then Anne Boleyn, then Catherine Parr. Well, Anne Boleyn was the second wife. And then Jane Seymour was the third one. Anne of Cleves, the fourth one, I think. Is that right? Maybe Anne of Cleves was third. I can never remember. And I think Catherine Howard was the fifth one. Catherine Parr was the last one. Yeah, I just thought I'd, you know, we'd kind of listen to this together today and comment a little bit on each of the tracks. I mean, this is so mental, this album. It was kind of insanely ambitious, cost quite a bit of money to put together, reading around it. It's actually got backing by the Straubs, who was one of the bands that Wakeman was involved with at some point. He's probably best known for being in Yes. You know, it's progressive rock. I'm not that into progressive rock, typically, but this album is just so out there and so mental that I wanted to kind of share with you some of my experiences of listening to it. I also, just a few notes before we go into it. I think there is something ridiculous, like 15 different keyboards played, on this album. I mean, I'll just read for you what it says. He plays two Mini Moog synthesizers, two 400D Mellotrons. He plays, a Steinway 9 grand piano, a custom-built Hammond C3 organ, an RMI electric piano, a harpsichord, an ARP synthesizer, a Thomas Goff harpsichord, a massive church organ in an actual church, and a portative organ. I mean, you should be seeing, like, different images of Rick Wakeman playing this album live, you know, from different eras. He famously in 2009 on the 500th anniversary of Henry VIII's death, played this album in its entirety at Hampton Court. I mean, just so eccentric, so mad. There's something about this that kind of perked my interest. It's, I mean, as you'll see, a lot of the keyboard sound, you know, that it's very 70s, kind of a bit of cheesiness in there. But there's also something else going on. And clearly, parts of this are very evocative of the 16th century. Other parts of it, you know, J.S. Bach is clearly an inspiration as well. And well, anyway, let's play the first track and then I'll say a bit more. So this is Catherine of Aragon. So already just absolutely mental. I mean, I don't know what any of these tracks really have to do with the wives of Henry VIII. I mean, he claims that the music is meant to be evocative of how they felt towards Henry, how he felt towards them, and kind of reflective of their life. I have to be honest, I don't really get any of that listening to it, but it is just bonkers. I've got a bit of an interview from when he did the Hampton Court gig. And let me just read you some of the stuff he says. He says, this album started, he said, I'll go back a bit in time. I actually signed a contract to do Sixth Wives with A&M in 1970. I was with the Straubs, who were signed to A&M Records. But in the late 60s and the early 70s, record companies started getting a hell of a lot smarter. In the 60s, Dubious Management would sign a band to a label for a lot of money, record an album, and then the band was split up. Back then, you signed with a band, and you also signed individually, although the latter was just an option. It was all very fair. I joined Yes and recorded Fragile in 1971, and initially it came out on Atlantic in the UK and later in America. We were on tour in the States at the time, and my manager, Brian Lane, said Jerry Moss from A&M Records had called and he'd like to see me. So we went down to A&M, which was Charlie Chaplin's old film studios. I had never really sat down in the executive's office before. So they asked if I wanted some coffee, and I said I'd rather have a scotch. This was back in my drinking days, and it was only 9 a.m. Anyway, Moss showed us round the lot, and it was fantastic. And he said that they had an option on me because of the Straubs thing. He said, word in the business is that Yes is going to be a very big band. If that's so, then we should probably put out a solo album. I'd never really thought about it before, but it sounded like Christmas. So I said, yes, please. I got an advance for $12,500. And at the time, at the rate of exchange, that came out as £4,000. Sterling was pretty strong in those days. And he also said that they'd like to give me a gift, as it was my first trip to America, a signing on gift. So Brian says, how much are you going to spend? And it was about $500 to $1,000. We were only getting $200 a week on tour, out of which came all your expenses and food. Walking down to the old lot, I'd passed a used car lot and seen this battered old 1957 Cadillac for sale at $795. So I mentioned this and Jerry said, I'll have a look. I'll have somebody look at it. Anyway, Brian calls me and says, they're sending you round a hi-fi brochure. The car's a wreck. And I say, I don't want a hi-fi, I want the car. So they got me the car and shipped it back to England. I don't have it anymore. I lost it in the first divorce. But that was my signing on fee. A limo weighed 3 tons and did about 3 miles to the gallon. A&M asked me what I wanted to do, but as Yes were so busy, they didn't put me under any time constraints. They were a wonderful company. So anyway, I wonder what to do. I didn't sing. I didn't have a band. I didn't know what to do. And I actually had a bit of a plan a few years before, which was to do The Journey to the Center of the Earth, which was one of his later albums. I'd always wanted to do that, but there was no way that was going to happen for my first record. So I was looking around for a concept. I've always loved the idea of concept. And I remember being at an airport in Richmond, Virginia, and they had a little store. This was in the days before portable cassettes. So all you could do on the plane was read. I hadn't bought a book along, so I was looking at what they had in store, and there was one little book called The Private Life of Henry VIII. So I bought that. And while I was reading about Anne Boleyn, a melody I'd written a few weeks before came into my head. And the more I read about her, the more this tune stayed in my head. And then I started reading about another wife, and these sounds just came into my head, and the concept started to come to the fore. Came back to England, read up on Catherine of Aragon, and decided that music wasn't supposed to be linked to factual matters, but would be more abstract. Back then, a lot of tapes were going missing from studios, so everything was given a pseudonym to try to prevent them from going missing. And the pseudonym for Catherine of Aragon was Handle With Care by the Joe Loss Orchestra. I had the Joe Loss Orchestra down for so many of my tapes that when these studios closed down and they returned stuff to the rightful owner, I never got my tapes back. Joe Loss's widow probably has all of mine. Okay, so let's listen now to the next track, and I'll come back to this interview soon. So the next track is Anne of Cleves.
We'll be right back.
just absolutely bonkers. Now, I have read around a little bit on this album, and some of the other people, like the Straubs members and the bassist and the various guys, were talking about their experiences of recording this album, and they said that Wakeman didn't actually tell them, like, they just played their parts separately and he put them all together afterwards, which is a little, I mean, so they, none of them had any concept of what it was going to sound like at the end. I mean, clearly Wakeman is a bit of a kind of crazy genius, but anyway, let's continue with this interview that I'm reading. So he says, anyway, I called up Chris Squire and Steve Howe and Bill Bruford and told them what I was doing, and they were all up for it. So the recording of the first album was pretty much Yes, minus John Anderson. So those are the members of Yes. I'm guessing that Yes and the Straubs were the same people. Is that right? Let me just look this up a minute. Straubs. See, I remember the Straubs for that song, We're All Part of the Union. I don't see any of the same. Let me just, sorry, I'm just trying to make sense of this. So this is the band Yes. Yes had Steve Howe. Oh, I see. Yes are one of those bands who've had many, many, many members. And the Straubs. All right, so there's tons of the same people in both of these bands. Okay, that makes sense. Right, okay. Yes, all right. Sorry, they're clearly quite related, these two bands, Yes and the Straubs. I've never really put those two together because they sound quite different, you know. Interesting. Okay, I mean, Yes are a lot more kind of, to my mind, a lot more experimentally than the Straubs were. But anyway, let's continue. So anyway, these people, Chris Squire, Steve Howe, Bill Bruford, it was Yes minus John Anderson. It was quite a few months before I got back in the studio because Yes were so busy. But over the next 6 months or so, we gradually put together all the music with various other musicians. It was all recorded on a 16-track, which was a fairly new thing at the time, and there were lots of problems involved. I remember very profoundly taking the tapes down to A&M in London, and the American lawyer had been sent over to collect the tapes. He stood up and made a little speech, and there were about eight of us in there. So I put the record on, played the first side, and there was no reaction. And then I played the second side, and there was even less reaction. They had a big cocktail cabinet in the corner, so I hit that. And then the lawyer says, well, this is all sounding very good, Rick, but it'll be a big help when we can hear it with vocals on. And then I said, there are no vocals. It's an instrumental keyboard album. Like a lot of Americans, he couldn't talk quietly. And he leant over to my publisher, Derek Green, and said, do you mean we've just paid $12,500 for a fucking piano player? And Derek said, yes. But he's a good piano player. And then he turned back to me, as I hadn't heard it, and said, this is going to be tremendous, and left. So I'm left there on my own, because the boss had said to Brian, my manager, I think we better have a chat. To cut a long story short, the two A&R guys came to me and said that they really liked it, and that it was really off the wall. They said, don't worry about those guys. All they want to hear is mainstream. We'll give it a go for you. And when we came to do the cover, we had to do it in black and white because they wouldn't pay for colour. But in the end, we managed to get a sepia tone that was used for the album cover. But I didn't care. I was just happy to have an album. There's something about this particular album that I just cannot believe it was made. It's just so off the wall. So let's listen to Catherine Howard. The next track, which is, we'll listen to it and then I'll say a bit and we'll come back to this interview. ¶¶ I mean, what have the honky-tonk bits got to do with Catherine Howard? I mean, he's kind of... I mean, the concept is pretty loose, I have to say. But, I mean, that... Like, isn't that mental? It's just mental. I don't really know what to say about it other than... It just... It's all over the place. And, you know, all right, so let's carry on with this interview. So he says, it got mixed reviews, but what made me happy was that the public got it. Worldwide, it has sold 14 million copies. I remember collecting my platinum discs from the head of A&M in the UK in Mid-M, yearly music conference in Cannes. And this was the bloke who hated it. He stands up and says, every now and then something special lands on your desk. And the moment this landed, I knew we had something really special. I was standing there gobsmacked as he passes me and whispers, don't say a word. But I had such a great relationship with A&M. It was always going to be called The Sixth Wise of Henry VIII. But the plan was to have a piece about Henry as well, called Defender of the Faith. But when I went to record it, the engineer is like, what are you going to do with it? Put a scroll in the middle? The album was full up, so it got ditched, i.e. they couldn't fit any more on the actual vinyl disc. The Defender of the Faith we're going to play now, one of the three pieces written for the Hampton Court show. So he goes on and talks about, you know, the Hampton Court show now, so we won't go into that. So let's listen to the next track then, because this is the one I think that... this is Jane Seymour, and this is where he brings in the actual church organ. And it was when this track came on that I was thinking, like, something interesting is going on this album. It is, you know, for those of you who listen to my kink shows, I'm always interested by people who are doing stuff that is slightly out of step with the time, doing something truly countercultural, if you want to put it that way. And I honestly think that Jane Seymour by Rick Wakeman is just an... It's just a kind of audacious track to record in 1973 on a church organ with strains of J.S. Bach in there in a kind of rock and roll context. You know, it's... You know, I have this idea that a lot of the British acts around this time, I think, were kind of rediscovering a European vernacular within the American form of rock. And this is one of the things that really interests me about this album, because it's, you know, it's English subject matter. It's a kind of virtuoso piano, pianist, keyboard player, doing something really interesting. And to me, I think he's doing exactly this. He is rediscovering a distinctly European form, a distinctly authentic kind of voice within this kind of American dominated context. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this stream, really, to think more about this. So here's Jane Seymour. Thank you. just incredible, really. If you want to know a bit more about the actual church, it was actually the church, the pipe organ at St. Giles Without Cripple Gate. Here's a picture of it here, which is in Barbican in London. So, yeah, he also in there is a Moog synthesizer, which comes in pretty strong at various points. There's also the Thomas Goff model harpsichord in there as well. I mean, just bonkers. And again, I don't know what it's got to do with Jane Seymour at all, really. I mean, I don't know if Jane Seymour was particularly religious. I mean, looking at her Wikipedia, it says, as queen, Jane was said to be strict and formal. The lavish entertainments, gaiety and extravagance of the queen's household, which had reached its peak during Anne Boleyn's time, was replaced by strict decorum. She banned the French fashions of Anne, right? Anne Boleyn had introduced French fashions to the court. Jane Seymour banned them. Politically, Jane appears to have been conservative. Her only reported involvement in national affairs in 1536 was when she asked for the pardons for the participants in the Pilgrimage of Grace. Henry is said to have rejected this, reminding her of the fate of her predecessor when she meddled in his affairs, based King Henry. Her motto as a queen was bound to obey and serve. Okay, so that may explain why Jane Seymour had this kind of more religious feel on the album. You know, I'm trying to think now about some of the previous tracks we've heard. I mean, maybe the Catherine of Aragon one was... I mean, I don't really see the connection. The Catherine Howard one, I think, is, you know, that was jauntier. And if you have a read of what she was like, you know, it says Catherine was young, joyous, and she was carefree. She was too young to take part in the administrative matters of state. And, you know, her track is a bit more jaunty and feels a bit more like a knees up. You know, from what I remember reading about Catherine, you know, she was a bit of a kind of sex object for, you know, the aging king at that point. You know, she brought the French fashions back, which Jane Seymour had done away with. So, you know, she was a bit more of a party time queen. And obviously Jane more kind of somber. So I'm starting to appreciate the connection between the music and the different characters here. So let's listen to the Anne Boleyn one now. Thank you. So, I mean, clearly that's quite a dramatic track. And, you know, if you understand the relationship, I guess, but, you know, the affair that Anne Boleyn had with Henry VIII, and then the kind of, you know, it was, you know, the romance, and then the failure to give him a son, and then the her execution and the rockiness, you know, there's quite a lot. There's quite a lot happening in that track, and it kind of mixes passion with sadness. So I can kind of, I'm starting to appreciate the different moods that he's going for on this album. And you know, now I'm really thinking about it during this stream. I'm starting to see it a bit more. I should have mentioned earlier, by the way, that Wakeman was the guy who played piano on Hunky Dory. So there's a bit of a Bowie connection there for those of you who watch the Bowie Deepest Laws. I've actually pulled up some trivia about the album that may be of interest. The cover photo that you see is not a montage. It was taken at the Madame Tussauds Wax Museum in London. So that's a picture literally of the waxworks with Rick Wakeman standing in front of it. The music was recorded in several stages, sandwiched between sessions and tours with the band Yes. Wakeman brought into the studio whatever musicians were available at the time, including colleagues from Yes and ex-colleagues from the Straubs. Okay, so not all of the tracks have the same band members on. Catherine of Aragon has Yes on it. Catherine Howard has the Straubs on it, which may account for the slightly jauntier feel of that as well, because he had a different band there. With his star reputation, recording with David Bowie, Elton John, Cat Stevens, and a solo contract with a Nether Record, Wakeman had a special status with Yes. He always kept a bit to himself. Yes guitarist Steve Howe called him the old pub man. Rick Wakeman was known to wear a cape during stage performances, and this is also cool because I love capes. I mean, I think Rick Wakeman is one of the least cool people ever, but, you know, for that reason, he's of special interest to me, because I love desperately out of sync people. I love uncoolness, you know. Supposedly, he used it to hide his spidery arm movements on keyboard. Each of the six pieces offers an alternating bath of musical moods and keyboard colours. Hammond organ next to romantic or virtuoso piano, bizarre synthesizer parts next to harpsichord, boogie, and hints of Bach on the pipe organ. Well, we've heard all of that already. There's one track left which is going to play us out. It's going to be Catherine Parr to play us out. A seventh piece intended to portray Henry VIII had to be omitted. Well, we've covered that. Wakeman mounted quotes from it into the other bit. So there's bits of actual the Henry VIII piece in the other tracks. 8 months after the album's release, Rick Wakeman was voted the best keyboardist by readers of Melody Maker. Wakeman's role model was the American keyboardist Michael Quattro, the older brother of Susie Quattro. The King Henry subject haunted Wakeman into his nightly dreams. After witnessing Anne Boleyn's execution in a dream, he added a 19th century hymn, "The Day Thou Gavest Lord Is Ended," to the piece. And yes, we should have mentioned that, or I should have mentioned that after the piece we've just listened to, Anne Boleyn. There's a 19th century hymn in there. On concert tours with Yes, Wakeman often played a solo melody from The Six Wives, the focus on the first piece, Catherine of Aragon. The music from the album was performed in its entirety for the first time in 2009 with a choir and orchestra, and that was that Hampton Cork gig that we were talking about. So there we go. I mean, I do think that this is a remarkable album. I don't even know about a star rating for things like this. It almost seems kind of reductive to give an album like this a star rating, because it's not It's so unconventional. I should mention that, probably of interest to a lot of people here, if you like this, his next album is called The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. So, you know, thinking about somebody doing something a little bit genuinely countercultural, I do think Rick Wakeman was kind of on his own planet in the mid-70s here. I think it's worth remembering that the whole keyboard thing was right at the... I have another interview that I've pulled up here, and I'll just let Wakeman tell it himself. He says, in the Sixth Wise of Henry VIII era, keyboards were still very much in their infancy, but were getting better. I just thought there was no outlet for keyboards as such. Keyboards were becoming more important in bands. Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer did a lot, but that was mainly Moog and organ. I wanted to use a lot more keyboard stuff and thought the keyboard needed a new outlet. So it was very much a new adventure. So, yeah, I mean, another part of this album was showing off what keyboards could do, which, I mean, I think, you know, if any part of the album sounds a bit quote unquote dated, it's probably that. But I actually like that. I actually love the early 70s keyboards and, you know, discovering what they can do with it and all of that. There weren't even keyboard stands at this time. I went to a few companies and asked if they could make me a keyboard stand, and they laughed at me and asked, why? You're the only person who sticks them on top of each other, so why bother? The funny thing is that a good number of years ago, I walked into a pub in Richmond, and there was a guy at the piano, and he had two keyboards on top of the piano. And as I walked by, he said, oi, this is your fault. And I thought that was really quite sweet. So there we go. All right, so to play us out then, Catherine Parr. Hope you enjoyed this. I don't expect many people to watch this, but I wanted to put out a Deepest Lore today. Let me know what you think in the comments. All right, this is Catherine Parr.